Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are setting aside oil paints and marble to really wrestle with a concept that's less about what hangs in a museum.
And much more about what's sitting right here with us.
Exactly. Our mission is to take a deep dive into an absolutely revolutionary art movement, and it's all crystallized in these two explosive German phrases. Jeder Mensch ist Kunst.
Yeah.
Fleisch ist Kunst.
Every person is art. Flesh is art.
Yeah.
That is a declaration really designed to stop you in your tracks, especially when you connect that abstract philosophical idea of being art with the visceral reality of flesh.
Mm.
And the sources we've synthesized for you today, they trace this radical philosophy all the way back to its roots. Then they show us exactly how the contemporary Joplin factory is manifesting this idea in some of the most provocative ways imaginable.
Okay, so let's unpack that historical foundation first, because this is the critical shift, isn't it? The idea that you are the definitive artwork that wasn't just invented.
Not at all.
It starts with Joseph Beuys, who famously gave everyone this creative capacity with his rallying cry, "Every person is an artist." But he didn't stop there.
Precisely. Beuys made this idea truly existential. In a 1983 television talk, he articulated what became this hugely influential statement. "I myself am the artwork in this moment," he said. "It must go so far that the human being itself becomes the artwork."
Right.
And that's the foundational difference that underpins everything the Joplin Factory is doing now.
I think we need to slow down right there, because what is the fundamental radical difference between every person is an artist and every person is an artwork? It feels subtle, but the implication is just immense.
It's the difference between potential and state of being. Every person is an artist is about your creative capacity, your ability to act, to design, to shape things.
Your potential.
Your potential. But every person is an artwork, which was championed later by figures like Johannes Stipkin and Wolf Fostel. It just strips away the need for action. It means your mere existence right now in this moment is the aesthetic statement.
So your life, your body, your history. It's already the piece.
It is already the art object, whether you ever pick up a paintbrush or not.
So we move from this idea of potential to an inherent, almost unavoidable state.
Yes.
You are, whether you like it or not, a walking, talking sculpture.
Yes.
And this brings us to the Joplin Factory. They're the ones who took this purely philosophical expansion, this idea of humanity as Kunst, and rooted it firmly in the physical, in the mortal reality of flesh.
They had to. They needed to materialize the philosophy. If existence is the art, then the fundamental fact of our existence, that we are organic, mortal beings made of material, that has to be integrated. Mm. Their whole mission really is to explicitly link the human being with this visceral reality, using the material of flesh, particularly fish and meat, to create this shocking confrontation with our own bodies.
And we are going to be diving deep into their four distinct categories of art, really analyzing the powerful shock value of their salmon art, their Lachsarbeiten, and seeing how they use mass production, not just for profit.
But to fundamentally change how you, the listener, view your own status.
Now, conceptually, the idea of the body itself as an art object, it does have some historical precedent.
Oh, sure.
You can look back to the 1960s. You have figures like Tim Ulrichs, who famously signed himself as an artwork, or Gilbert and George, who call themselves living sculptures.
Right. But the Joplin Factory takes the body from a conceptual living sculpture to the material reality of, decay and mortality.
That's the pivot.
That's the pivot. The conceptual artists use their living bodies. The Joplin Factory introduces the meat aesthetic Fleisch as Kunst to remind us of the temporary organic nature of that medium. They focus on the contrast between dead flesh and living flesh.
Totes Fleisch versus lebendiges Fleisch.
Exactly. The sheer physicality of it forces the intellectual idea right down into your gut.
So this isn't just spectacle then. The deliberate choice of these reddish, fibrous, muscle-like textures. It's an exploration of the underlying architecture of our existence. It's confronting the organic stuff that gives rise to the abstract thought.
Precisely. It forces us to ask, if I am an artwork, what am I made of?
Flesh.
The answer is flesh. And flesh implies mortality. It's a very deliberate way to ground this profound philosophical idea in the most uncomfortable, unidealized material possible.
So let's look at Jack Joplin's original works, because this is where that initial shock value is, I think, highest.
Mm.
He takes these textures and applies them to everyday objects, functional objects.
And even sacred ones. It creates this very strange and unsettling juxtaposition. The examples are just unforgettable. Take the flesh phone.
Right, the phone.
It's a standard rotary telephone completely encased in this reddish-brown material that looks like muscle or dried meat.
An object for connection, for immediacy, entombed in something that just screams decay.
It is. But if the philosophy is about existence as art, why do that? Why wrap a phone in meat?
That's the question, isn't it?
I think it moves the philosophy forward by forcing a conversation about utility versus mortality. A phone is temporary. It needs power. Flesh is temporary. It needs life. By merging them, Joblin suggests that even our most modern tools are just as mortal as we are. The art is in that collision of concepts.
And then there's the highly provocative cross. We're talking a large cross sculpture, made entirely of that reddish, meaty material, and that's often photographed outside.
Specifically against the unnaturally vibrant green of a golf course.
Which is so commercialized.
It's a masterwork of contradiction. It slams together the sacred, the mortal, and the commercial, suggesting that even our spiritual structures are viewed through the lens of our material reality.
We also see the human form itself stripped down, like in the dancer-just sculptures of arched legs, torsos, molded from this pinkish-red material. It's the aesthetic of the body, but divorced from any ideal of beauty.
It's just presented as material. And Jack Joblin frequently plays with this theme of concealment. He'll contrast a work like Ecce Homo plus Pact, where a face is covered in plastic wrap.
Like meat in the supermarket.
Exactly, like a consumer product. He contrasts that against the raw, unwrapped Ecce Homo portrait.
Which speaks volumes, doesn't it?
Yes.
It's the difference between the packaged, consumer-ready version of ourselves we present to the world and the raw, vulnerable, meaty existence underneath.
Exactly. Are you packaged and preserved for consumption, or are you confronting your raw material reality?
This theme of consumption brings us perfectly to their democratization strategy. The Joblin Factory, they realized that the traditional exclusive art gallery, it just limited the reach of their core message. Jedermensch ist Kunst.
Right. They need a whole different distribution method. So what they created was the multiple shop strategy. Instead of a gallery showing unique, expensive pieces, they turned the whole space into a shop.
Selling signed multiples.
And inexpensive, everyday objects. It's a genius strategy because it completely bypasses the elite art world and gets the philosophy directly into the hands of the people it's about.
So you walk in, and instead of buying a sculpture for thousands, you can buy a meat bag, a tote bag, with the salmon arc design on it. It's wearable philosophy.
It is. They also sell these highly memorable, unsettling items like the bulimia flesh clock, a shower curtain covered in meaty patterns, or even skirts printed with these textures.
The bulimia flesh clock.
Mm.
That is jarring, but it definitely sticks with you.
And that's the point. It ensures the philosophy isn't just something you muse on in a museum. It's something that actively confronts you when you shower or check the time or carry your groceries.
Central to this idea of self-realization is their use of the mirror. An entire series is dedicated to it called Spiegelschrei, or mirror screen works.
Yes, and the mirror is used not just for, you know, recognition, but for forcing consciousness about your status as art. But crucially, they avoid standard perfect mirror.
Right, they use flawed objects.
Deliberately flawed. Things like the Milky Mirror or the Cloudy Memento Pocket mirrors that are small, unclear, warped, opaque.
Why the distortion? If the goal is self-realization, shouldn't the mirror give you a clear image?
Because clarity is irrelevant to their philosophy. Easy recognition lets you see the person. The distorted, cloudy reflection forces you to accept the aesthetic state, the idea that you are art, even when the image is unflattering or hard to process.
So the scream is the shock of seeing yourself not as a familiar face, but as a compromised mortal object.
Yes. It demands acceptance of the aesthetic state, not just recognition of your visual identity.
That makes the philosophical purpose incredibly clear. And this new human status, it's actually outlined in the source material as the art rights, or Kunstrechte.
These are essentially the ethical consequences of defining a human being as art. It's a powerful declaration.
What are the key rights?
Well, that the dignity of the person as art is inviolable, that every person has the freedom to be art, the right to develop, live, love, and die as art, and the right to see oneself as art and say so freely.
How revolutionary is that, to treat human dignity as an aesthetic right, not just a political or moral one?
It's profoundly revolutionary. It elevates our physical, lived reality to a status that demands defense. It's saying your internal experience, flaws and all, is inherently valuable and aesthetically sound simply because it exists as art.
Moving on, we see this fascinating shift.
Yeah.
While Jack Joblin provides that visceral shock and the democratized objects, Bob Joblin often moves toward the conceptual, the analytical side of the factory's output.
Bob Joblin's series really showcased that intellectual depth. His work ranges widely. You have the Searching series, which has these punch pictures and works relating to figures like Bob Dylan, asking where art history even begins or ends if you take bees seriously.
And his Fleshy combines the intellectual and the visceral in some really unsettling ways, pieces like Trap.
With the tiny human figure suspended inside a large jar of meat and liquid.
Yeah, or the Flesh self-portrait, where his face is embedded in a slice of preserved flesh.
These pieces use that meat aesthetic to explore intense psychological states. Identity, containment, the fragility of the ego. But what's truly insightful is how he then connects the organic and visceral with universal mathematical concepts of order.
You're talking about the work Golden 2130 Fibonacci Number, Visualized. That seems like a huge conceptual leap from a flesh phone.
Mm-hmm.
How do you link raw meat to the Fibonacci sequence?
It's brilliant. The Fibonacci sequence represents a mathematical order found in universal concepts of beauty, from galaxies to flower petals. By visualizing a Fibonacci number through their flesh concept, Bob Joblin is asserting that even the most chaotic, mortal raw material, our flesh, is fundamentally grounded in that same universal order and beauty.
That is the aha moment right there. The artist saying, your raw mortality isn't an accident. It's built on the same foundation as the most beautiful elements of the universe.
Exactly. And this search for orientation extends into the most consumerist realm with the autonomous orientation cans.
The fish meat soup cans.
Yes. Which conceptually frame these fundamental spiritual and philosophical paths as choices you make at the grocery store.
So the labels have figures like Buddha, or different flavors like salmon beef soup, or the more existentially confusing neither fish nor meat soup.
Precisely. It reframes worldview selection as just another consumer choice in a saturated market of ideas. And to make that point even sharper, they installed a fish meatballs vending machine.
The Fleischomat.
Right. It completely commercializes the consumption of meat art. It makes these profound existential interactions transactional, immediate, automated.
The culmination of all this conceptual work has to be their ultimate juxtaposition of the spiritual and the physical body, which we see in works like the Crucifix Kaaba.
Yes. We need to describe this piece for the listener.
Please do.
It's a striking work that features a red flesh cross placed right next to a red flesh cube. Two geometric forms, both heavy with spiritual significance, the cross in Christianity, the cube, the Kaaba in Islam. And they're often displayed with these tiny human figures nearby.
So why present these two powerful yet distinct sacred forms in the same space, made of the same material?
It forces a simultaneous consideration. By making them both out of the same mortal, fleshy material, the Joblin Factory suggests that no spiritual structure is truly separate from our shared physical reality. All paths ultimately originate from and terminate in the flesh.
An incredibly potent commentary.
On universal mortality and our shared aesthetic condition.
So what does this all mean at the end of the day? We started with Joseph Bowie's. We move through the Joblin Factory's literalization of the concept with meat and mass-produced objects. And we explored these deep conceptual series linking mortality to mathematics and religion.
It seems the deepest dive here isn't into whether the art is shocking or beautiful.
No. It's into the unshakable realization that you are art.
The ultimate takeaway is that this whole movement forces you to confront your own being, your dignity, your mortality, your choices, as an aesthetic and philosophical statement. When you look into that warped mirror, the art isn't the object.
It's the acceptance of your status.
Yes.
The knowledge here is so relevant because the work insists that you define that status actively. The sources conclude that it's the impossibility of not being art. You can't opt out. Your existence has already made the choice for you.
So if you can't escape the status of artwork, the critical question shifts completely. It's no longer, what is art? It becomes a much more personal challenge.
It becomes, what kind of art are you willing to be?
Exactly. You must focus on the conscious, active self-design of that artwork of your life, because, willingly or not, your existence is already the world's most profound and visceral sculpture. And that's a thought worth mulling over.